Okay, so to summarize what we have said so far is, first of all, you have to collect data, and if you work for the business, then you have to figure out what are the metrics you want to run your business by. Victor and I talked about search engines, about clustering, and what metrics to understand how well is your search engine doing. Then, next level is that you do data analysis. You do data mining, you build descriptive models, and if you think well, then you build also predictive models. But predictive models, you can compare it with some baseline, you know whether you're doing better than chance or not. Then you got to the level of architecture experimentation. That's what I'm going to give you an example about for Amazon. And typically, they might be called A-B testing, where you run one version and the other version at the same time. Machine learning has the expression active learning. Active learning means that there are algorithms which tell you what questions you should ask right now in order to gain as much information from the answer as possible. And in another word, it might be called survey design. How do you actually design the experiments? How do you design the survey? And note, if some of you have taken design of experiments, you probably learned the wrong things. But what was scarce and what's abundant was different 100 years ago when famous people invented surveys and when invented experimental design. Because think about it, 100 years ago, subjects were rare. If you do experiments with rabbits, it takes a while until you have the next generation, even for rabbits. But on the other web, and I'm primarily a web guy here, on the web, you just wait for a few minutes and you have another 100 or 1,000 people. That shrinking of the time scale for experiments from months for rabbits or from months for, say, introducing a new toothpaste to hours or minutes in introducing a new online design is the heart of what's different in the algorithms and the approach we take right now. Subjects cost nothing. They come and they show everything they're interested in. Because if they don't tell the search engine exactly what they want to know, there's no way the search engine gives them an answer. It's not winking with your left eye, you know what I want, right? Which might do it in the store. But you have to be explicit. At Amazon, you have to be explicit what you're clicking at. If you don't do this, you don't get what you want for. And people learn. People are fast in learning. And to grunt to Google in saying, Visa, Russia, India, meaning where? In Russia, can I get a visa for India? Or maybe, where in India can I get a visa for Russia? So you see that our reduction of Google grunting isn't necessary what we want search engines to do. We would like them to have much more of a dialogical structure. That's where implementation comes in, active learning. We want the search engine to ask us that question, which is the most important question, like, which country do you want to get more? Third point is architecture of participation. Remember, share, discover. People do it, they want to express themselves, and what's hard for us, not the technology is not hard, but what's hard for us is to design incentives the right way. Again, we have hundreds of millions of people who potentially will take part in it, but they will just be gone. We don't incentivize them to do the right thing. And finally, architecture of interaction. How do we actually not only get those people to produce, how do we get them to interact with each other? Point one, data analysis. Let's go back a couple of thousand years. Egypt, the River Nile. You know that there were floods in the Nile. And guess who, were the people who were highly regarded, and we would say these days highly paid, in the Yes, the high priests, because they pretended to have some knowledge about when the next flood is going to come. Now, note, feedback, very long, order of years. Not order of minutes, but order of years. Note, outcome, pretty stochastic. If you say the flood will come in 3 years, and there's no flood in 3 years, hey, I couldn't really promise. You know what I mean? Same on Wall Street, by the way. Wall Street is a 0.5 plus epsilon. If you're right, a little bit better than 50%, you make it in Wall Street. Whereas physics is, of course, a 1 minus epsilon regime. You're better if you're still swinging this way. You're better right in 100% minus a very small epsilon percent. So that was the high priest. Let's fast forward. Notre Dame, churches. What was characteristic for the era of faith? Long feedback cycle. If you do this, just wait until you die. You'll have a better life afterwards. That easy to, you know, verify, I think. And highly stochastic outcome. Other examples are medicine. Well, exercise every day and, you know, you'll have a better life in 20 years. Or think about stock market. Just trust me. Sorry, I lost 90% of your money here. Hang in there. In the long run, you'll be doing well. So all of these things are from an era of faith, characterized by one, under-investment, despite massive investments in cathedrals, and no feedback or long feedback cycles. They're placed by an era of data. Again, massive investments that are not in the cathedrals, but measurement, networking, and storing. The return on investment, ROI, becomes measurable, and the feedback cycles are short. That's why communication really is at the heart of the internet. And we can do experiments. Now, lots of our behavior has been turned into data. For instance, music. Here is a screenshot of Mood Logic. How you listen tells us a lot about you, because we tend to listen to music which was created at a time when we socialized by listening to music. So you probably listen to different music from your professor. Or maybe not. Search. We already said that in search you reveal your preferences. Do you like boys or do you like girls? Italian food or Russian food? Do you like to be in the countryside or etc.? So all of those things get revealed in search. Online trading and online dating. In both cases, people reveal their preferences. They might very well say one thing. When it comes to talking to the computer, they really know that. They reveal how it really is for them. So everything can and will become data. Another example of data about people is, of course, their movement. GPS. So we know that we are not moving right now. All your phones are probably ready for that call, but the phones are not moving. We said about social tagging, about geographic tagging, that you move to tag buildings. Here's an example which I find very interesting, because the reason I put it in is Victor told me about his car insurance, that he has a GPS in there which he's not allowed to take out. So if somebody wants to know where he is, they can track the car at any time over time. So that means car insurance now here, this is an example from England, Norwich Union, lives on very different from before. Before it was, hey, you pay $1,000 this year and no, we insure your car. Then there was this thing afterwards that you pay $1,000 and if you drive less than so and so many thousand kilometers, we might be considering maybe next year charging you less. That was the second model. But this model now knows that we are driving at 3 o'clock in the afternoon from point A, where there are lots of bars, to point B. And it purely doesn't discriminate against us. But purely based on patterns, it turns out that people driving at 3 o'clock in the morning from the same A to B tend to have a higher rate of incident. So if you drive at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you pay less insurance in driving this path than if you drive at 3 o'clock at night. It's very interesting. What does that mean for society? What does it mean for pooling risk? What does it mean for responsibility of individuals? So these are questions which more transparency through measurement forces us to address. But back to the brain activity. People now with functional MRI can measure your brain activity as you look at ads. Cola or Coca-Cola, different neurons firing, different cubic millimeter fires. And now we know that if that millimeter fires, something else will be happening down the road, because that we have mapped. Versus if the other cubic millimeter fires, something else is happening down the road. And the first time you buy the product, and second time you are seeing, oh, the other product actually was better, and you buy the other product. Nothing. Everybody knows that Pepsi-Cola tastes better. Any blind taste shows it. Still, everybody has Coca-Cola. Think about analysis, microarrays. We have about 30,000 genes, which is about 1 billion base pairs. That's good work for computer scientists. And finally, think about RFIDs, radio frequency identifiers. Those little chips costing a couple of cents, about the size of a grain of salt. Those chips, which allow us to identify everything we wear, my socks, my clothing has a little RFID, so if I walk through the room, nobody needs to ask me who are you, because they already know it's the same guy who came yesterday. Presumably, people change the socks, and maybe they have the same shoes the day before, so you can get an exact mapping of who you are, just based on the things. Now, if, of course, you live a roommate and you drank vodka the night before and you put on his clothes in the morning and he puts on yours, then, you know, you might be confused about this. So one of the hard questions actually is, what do when data about people are not correct? What mechanisms do we build into this data collection engine if the data somebody has about me correct? Not easy. It goes back to the reputation system and that it needs smart mathematicians and game theorists to come up with solutions of how to fix data if they are incorrect. Okay, so again, storage is free. This I have. The disk alone would have been more than $1 million when I did my PhD 15 years ago. This year alone, the cost of a terabyte dropped by 85%. So storage is free. Communication is cheap. That means that the data we have being roughly the same because we can only give so many bits explicitly a day. However, the implicit data, like the movement data through our mobile phones, is exponentially. And the heart of it is really communication. What does it mean for a company like Amazon.com? Any year, if you look at the customer data, Amazon gets about 100 megabyte. Not much. If you look at the order data, it's about 10 gigabyte. It's about what fits on a little chip which fits in my camera. 8 gigabyte by now on the flash chips. If you look on the raw data, you have about 100 terabyte. How much does it cost, actually? How much is a terabyte? It depends on if you have an external disk, it's, you know, $500. If you have an internal disk, $200. So all the data Amazon is collecting within a year is how much? $200 times 10 is $2,000, about $20,000. So all the data actually the World Wide Web has costs less than my garage in Tesco. And it fits on a simple bookshelf. So if you want to take anything home from this talk, the data, it is free to store anything. Next point is that we talk about architectures of experimentation. And I don't know how many of you have a background in biology where you're very used to doing A-B tests. I want to give an example from Amazon. Home, add to shopping cart, click. So we're playing a game. Amazon now is bringing something back to you, namely add to the shopping cart, and actually a two-digit percentage of Amazon's revenues are coming from recommendations. So there are two kinds of recommendations. There are recommendations you buy in addition to something or complements. So for instance, you buy a laptop, it says, would you like to buy that battery with the extra battery with the laptop? Why? Because other people fill this matrix with AIJ. Is the cell which corresponds to people having bought a laptop battery within 24 hours. That cell gets incremented by one whenever a new customer buys that battery and that laptop. Early days at Amazon, actually people didn't consider the arrow of time. So it was just as likely that people buy this battery to buy that laptop. So hey, you're interested in the battery? How about the laptop to go with the battery? These are complements. They are based on the buying behavior. Now, same equations have the same solution. It's one of the famous sayings. So the same problem isomorphic to this is for substitutes, stuff you buy instead. But, of course, you can't use the purchasing data. In this case, you use what data? You use click data. Because as people are in this process of coming up with what they want to buy, they click on this camera and that other camera, and then they finally decide, this is the camera I'm buying. So, question for you. Two questions for you. How could you mix those two? Well, one really cool suggestion there is that you have people click at this, eventually buy that. So that's a really good feature, because as you're in this process of looking around, and maybe this camera, maybe that camera, maybe the other camera, and say, well, I'll help you out here. I know you're still thinking about what to buy, but people click on this, eventually buy that one. Push people further into the buy. And what does it do? It leverages what millions of people are thinking about and makes it easier for you to come to a purchasing decision. Interesting, there are of course positive feedback loops what could discover that, you know, if more people, even more people do so, it's actually a fixed point, which means that everybody will buy the same camera, but Amazon doesn't care. As long as people buy cameras, Amazon's happy. Now, simple question. Do you want to have this blue sign here, the shopping cart, on the inside, or do you want it left inside?
Right.
Okay, why? Okay, but you could argue the other way around. You could say you want on the left because your eyes go from right to left, as you just said. And, you know, I'm good with this, but now how about something else? So basically, we can argue until the cows come home. Are the cows in Moscow? Horses. Until the horses come home. Now, a way of arguing with this is say we have no idea, but we can measure it. So before we can measure it, what is it? And these are metrics. In this case, a conversion rate. Name the percent of visits that are placing an order, and maybe another metric, the order size. How many additional items from those recommendations actually get added? And it turns out that we happen to be right, that indeed it's about 1% better if you have that blue bar on the right-hand side. You are sure about it. And how long does it take you to come to that result? Well, again, physicists order of magnitude say about, say, a million events a day. Square root of 1 over 1 million is 0.1%. So after one day, you lose to 0.1%. Not bad. So maybe, you know, you're not so sure and the weather changes. Maybe it's different on Saturdays from Sundays from today. So you wait for a week and then you surely have measured a 1% effect. So that is how experimental design works. So I told you already here about what similar items do customers actually buy after viewing this item. And this shows you here is a DVD player. And actually, people buy this item, but 20% actually buy another item. So it helps by using the collective intelligence, the collective attention, it's about attention economy, of people to make Amazon a better site. And that's really the value Amazon.com has. Having harnessed the information users who are constantly currently concentrating on an item are into it. That is really where the value lies. I promised you two remarks. One was this one. What was the other remark? What happens if some people who should be in a world where we pick them to be on the clicking behavior by, let's say, clicking at many DVD players, that they actually are purchasing many DVD players? So it is a typical clicking behavior, but for them it's a typical purchasing behavior. What do you think that's happening there?
Didn't get what you're asking.
So I said that the click behavior tends to be about, like, I click on one DVD player and I click on another DVD player and the third one, and that tells me the items you can substitute for. But now, sometimes you see patterns which are different. For instance, in this case, we saw a pattern where somebody clicked on a DVD player and it, and he clicks on another DVD player and buys it, and yet another one and buys it. So what do you do in that case?
Well, So you just don't consider it in that analysis set.
Okay.
If the percentage of subs are really small, they can be considered outliers and rejected from the training set.
I know, you're absolutely right. From a machine learning perspective, that's a good answer, but what about a business perspective?
If it's one account of different users?
Well, when someone, you store that pattern, well, you just remember it as a sub, and when you see that guy bought the first DVD, and you treat him as a common one. And when he bought the second, him as the, because he has larger likelihood for the subgroup who buys many DVD players, so you treat the one who would buy many, so you give him a great, big list, so hey, you can buy this all.
Okay, now what would you do? Would you ship any of them?
We should consider if he, if others ordered many of them, actually, well, paid for them.
Good question. So they're very good, you know, well-organized, smart, because you're dealing with like five sigma effects, which means, you know, far out in the distribution in terms of intelligence. And it turns out that, you know, they're pretty good, and maybe they ship them even to slightly different addresses. And all people have to do there is repackage the box, put usually some Russian address or something like this on it, and ship it back. And so that's an example, beautiful example of fraud. Some person buying many different DVD players and all shipping them with the same credit card. So the machine learning part here is to figure out when to not ship something. Because if people, you know, receive a DVD player and they buy some credit card on the web, the chance that you actually see that money is pretty small. So fraud, there every day like 3,000 such cases at Amazon for sure. You want to have good people, like 20, 30 people who do nothing but build models of normal behavior and contrast in the most normal behavior. So that's what I wanted to say here about the things. Point number three, participation. Participation has many different forms. Let me start with something very simple. This here is a store in San Francisco, close to where I live. It's called Costco. And Amazon went through many cities in America, took pictures. Cameras with GPS, going shooting pictures. Now, what do you think is a good picture of the store? This one, or maybe that one? Or how about this one? No, this is the Coca-Cola drop. We know that Coca-Cola doesn't taste as good, but does better marketing. So, who should decide that? You know, make the decision of which is the best picture of that store. Do you think Amazon should be paying people to sort of actually go? Well, no, because they don't know the stores in the world. So the idea is that you create here an architecture where people can participate. And for instance, the guy who worked at the store can say, this is a good picture of the store. Goes back to the point we made before, that we need good incentive schemes, because somebody presumably is interested in a house. Somebody has some house they live in. And so as everybody to sort of tag or to organize the house they live in, and maybe the neighbors, you know, who knows where they have computer access, then you have a wonderful way of the world. Now, why would Amazon bother doing that? Well, there's this little button up there, click to call business. And when there is click to call, if somebody clicks on that button, money rolls into Amazon's pockets. They pay, the store pays for getting calls. And it's just like click on an ad and you pay the company which puts the ad down. It's here, click to call. Same business model. Now, there are actually companies now which have used good until cancel telephone numbers. I don't know whether you have that in Russia. So in China, for instance, on a dating site, every person you talk to gets a different virtual phone number. Very easy. You know, you just create virtual numbers and they all ring on the same phone. But then that guy keeps on calling you, you don't want to really hear all that much from anymore. Then you just go on the web interface and just uncheck that box. And he calls you, no answer anymore. And maybe he knows, you know, that you found somebody else and maybe you get back to him after another virtual didn't work out. But anyways, you can have lots of numbers and that's one solution to the spam problem.
Unchecked this phone and someone else found this phone is free, checked it out.
Okay.
And one person who someday tried to call you, he calls us another person.
No, the numbers, you know, if you have enough digits, there are more digits than you have people in the world. And so let's say you want to call me. So I give you a number and it only works when you call me.
But
now,
I use my ID or something like that, so they said it won't get overflown in some million years or something like that. Generate new IDs.
So new IDs, that's right. So now, however, you give my phone number to your friend. Your friend? Okay. So now your friend calls me, and I'm very happy to get his call too. Now maybe your friend gives it to his girlfriend, and you know she's a bit. I mean, I don't know. I just or to his boyfriend, you know, whoever, and maybe he's a bit weird. So I don't really, you know, want to hear from. So I just say, if that number gets called, you know, I don't answer anymore, and my phone doesn't ring anymore. So basically, every person you give a new email address, you should give everyone a new email address, and with the push of one button, you should be able to just not receive anything from this more. And the same with the phone here. Just send a short message, a text message after the call with a "niet," and nothing will arrive anymore. So the idea here, onward. We are talking about architectures of participation as opposed to interaction. This was already about interaction here, participation. One thing at Amazon.com is that at the bottom of every single page, there is a comment box or a suggestion box. It's very clearly mentioned to the customer that he or she should not expect any response to this. So they say here, for example, the page takes too long to load. They enter this. That online information is combined with the path they took through the trajectory they took through the website. We know what happened, and there's order of 1,000 such things every day coming back, and so manually sorts them and things get fixed. Think about that, you know, quality assurance that you have millions of people deep inside every day by making it really easy for them to give feedback. That's an example of architecture of participation. People are good people. People like to help. There's an interesting phenomenon in America called Craigslist.org. And at Craigslist, there are many people who are just really making the community work out really beautifully. For free. No pay. No financial pay. Maybe good reputation. Or maybe they feel that because they found something or someone who really, you know, did something which they liked, that they're happy to support that by helping out other people as well. Clicks, so far, only allow you to click on something which is given on the site. Not all that much of you is entering in a click. You have a site, all you can do is click. Search, more of you is being brought in search because it expresses intention. But the search you enter in the box, caviar blini, doesn't really tell you anything about the results. So that's the intention economy, as we said, $150 billion monetization Google. Now I want to talk about what's happening in the attention economy. And that is really cool because you can tag stuff, you can label stuff. Here's an example. The example is delicious. Some people say tags are distilled attention. Tags are a pure form of attention. Or they say, you are what you eat. Like they say, you are what you eat. Or they say, you are what you're tagged as. Or who you are tagged by. Sometimes, and I had an interview recently which said, I tag, therefore I am. So you see tagging, which really is a good form of expressing attention. The site I want to talk about now is called Delicious. And I want to talk about tagging and discovery. So here's an example where a URL, which has this description, housing maps, Craigslist, Google, has a tag, in this case, maps, a user, in this case, Lawrence Lee, and actually 446 other people who tagged that site. It allows me to discover more about that stuff. More maps, more URLs that were tagged with the tag maps. So in some way, a different geography, a different web, a different network is put on top of the word, which now links things which people who are in charge of the websites would never put on its website, like a link editor, but they have the same tag. And you use the attention of people that these two things are same, they have the same tag, and allow people to discover things they which would have been much harder to discover before. That's what you get to a tag. Second is you can follow a user and you can discover what is Lawrence Lee interested in. You see all the tags and you see all the websites he tags. Very interesting. And thirdly, you see who are the people, those 446 people, who are they who are interested in this specific website? So I always like to see at Vigen who has tagged Vigen.com and Delicious and those 70, 80 people Who are they? So that's what tags do to you. That is the example of delicious. Here's another example, second example from a Yahoo company I wanted to give you, Flickr. This is a friend of mine. His name is Lawrence Lee. Quentin Lee, filmmaker. And he has made movies like Drift, Ethan Now. And the features which Flickr provides is that others can now comment my picture. So you see that there is a certain dialogue starting. And others can add tags to this here. So this, getting this right, looking at different sizes, blogging about it, creating those arc interaction is a step from going from the participation of just posting an image like this to actually getting to know the people. So this slide summarizes what's happening right now. This was the old world. People deciding on meaning, the rest of the world receiving the meaning. This is the new world. Everybody deciding on meaning. And Ludwig Wittgenstein, an Austrian philosopher who then died in Cambridge, he said, meaning equals use. Meaning, I don't care whether there's any meaning behind the meaning, behind the meaning, behind the meaning. What matters is how to be a certain term. And I don't look things up in a dictionary anymore. I just look things up when I want to know the spelling on Google or in Yahoo. And 73 people spell it that way. Then probably I got it wrong, as opposed to 47 million spelled it that way. So example of meaning equals use. So we moved in some way from a one-to-many or from a few-to-many relationship to a many-to-many relationship. The examples I gave you are delicious and Flickr. Another example I invite you to check out is called 43things.com. So I'm moving into the direction of interaction. What does it mean for e-business? How do we get from this to me business and maybe to us business? Look at this graph here. Pages, individual pages, get aggregated to a visit. So if you look in your server log, cookie, same session ID. So you make individual page views, found the same session cookie to a visit. You then aggregate visitors, if he has a cookie or if he logs in, to a customer. Okay? So you say he's a customer or user. Same guy as before. The interesting part is to make customers or users to a network of customers. How can we make money with this? On the page, the model, statistical model we have, the mathematical model we built is the model about the content. We then show ads based on that content. Unfortunately, Google already does that and another number of companies, so there is not much money to make in that space anymore. The second level is the level of the visit. A lot of space to be made in that space. Model the intention or the situation or the mode, the modality of the user, and I sometimes call this session-based marketing. We figure out, what does he really want? Does he want a book for himself? Or just something for his mother-in-law, just to get it done, you know, anniversary or something like that. Here are some examples of the modalities of the visit. Is it a plan that's been deliberating on? This is always an impulse visit. Gina, I just want to look at what's new there. Is it a personal visit or a job-related visit? Person at home or at work? Is he in a hurry? Quickly, let's get this done before the last subway leaves. Or does he have time to kill Gino? What do I do today in the next hour until I can finally leave the office because my boss is still here? Is he, you know, just early in the process of creating and maintaining product space awareness or ready to make a decision? These are all examples on the visit. So what do you think? Does it need complicated models to come up with such ideas? We thought so. But then we realized we can do it much more easily. Namely, just ask. For example, here, a dating site. What are you looking for today? A chat? I'm looking for a date? I'm looking for hooking up now? I'm going to travel in the area? All these things, just ask the people in your body. That was here on the visit level. Thirdly, the customer. We can model demographics, where they live, etc. And we can do personalization. Not easy. One insight to share with you is in this spectrum of information, which ranges from very old information, like their zip code, over their past information, what they have been buying in the past, what they have been looking at the past, giving rise to so-called behavior targeting, to the current station, intention, and modality. Whereas initially I thought it's the past behavior which determines most what the person is. It turns out that it is much more important to understand their current intention and their current modality in order to do a good job in this case, serving them what they're looking for. That was one of the insights. So build models such as relational probabilistic models that allow you to figure out what the person is interested in right now. Much better return on investment than doing this complicated customer relationship management stuff, where based on the book you bought 3, I think you want to buy this book now. Finally, network. I'm not sure who of you knows about social networks. They're really interesting ideas, how you look at a graph. And the question is, how can you apply some of the results of search to, in this case, us business, not only e-business, but us business. And share one insight with you, which is the insight that for many people, the customer lifetime value has an intrinsic value, which is how much money a company like Ozon will be making off you in the next 50 years or expect to live. That for many people here, the smartest people in the country, the opinion leaders of the country, is only a fraction of what the company Ozon will make by the people who you will influence on what they should be buying. So if you now all go out and say, hey, you know, the professor said this book is really great, and all your friends go buy the same book, then Ozon makes more money off your professor than by telling you and you telling your friends about the book, then your professor can end your life. So that's the idea that you use ideas how you can measure the customer network value into this relatively simplified measured customer lifetime value, which is just, you know, how much did you buy last year, maybe with a gradient and exponential discount in the future. So how does one put this as a physicist into an experiment? How do you create an architecture so we figure out what is your network value? Here's how it works. Let's say you buy a book. What's your name?
Michael.
Michael buys a book. Have you bought a book?
Yeah, of course I have.
What book?
Last time it was about psychology.
Good. Michael bought a certain psychology book. Let's say at Amazon. After this process concluded, after we have his money, we say, hey, Michael, we're wondering, do you have any friends who you might think might be interested in the book? Or might be interested in the book, why don't you just shove over some of these email addresses? And hey, no, if at least one of them buys within a week, I give you 10% back. And by the way, your friend also gets a 10% discount. So, you know, your friend doesn't think that you are selling him. So Michael, of course, thinks hard and comes up with a few of his friends. And they all get emails that says, hey, your partner just bought that book and thought you might be interested in that. Of course, this is not spam, right? Because Michael just suggested that, you know, you might book. And presumably Michael is a smart guy. He presumably thinks about people who actually are interested in psychology book. And maybe there is this long lost friend who didn't really know how to write to anymore, but that's just a good way to remind her of you that you still exist and that you bought that psychology book. So now what analysis do? Analysis looks now after the week. Well, first of all, do you participate in this? How many friends do you have? And do you actually have any influence over them? So when Amazon launched that feature, there were some people who sent out 5,000 such emails. What do we conclude from that? Yeah, I know, lots of friends. But besides that, what do we conclude from that? Well, we're the author of the book. And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, bad because the reputation goes down. The reputation of this service goes down.
Not necessarily. Hey, you know, he made his 10% of his own book, admitted it, not a very big percentage. But he got his friends, first of all, to know that he came out with the book, saying, buy that book, and Amazon sold more books. So something which maybe looks like fraud is the question for Amazon. Would those 5,000 guys, or however many of them he bought, have bought this book elsewhere instead? And if the answer is, yeah, a good fraction would elsewhere, then probably for everybody, this is a good deal. Besides, Amazon might have some new email addresses who they can recommend other psychologists. So you see that it's not just about the surface structure, whether the button is red or the button is green, whether the blue bar is in the left, blue bar is in the right. Those things we can do through experiments. But we have to be really smart and come up with specific experiments in order to measure these things, in order to have a really great product, in order to ultimately, you know, sell more stuff. Now, this was a social network. Graphs here shows you an associated network with that, namely the network of books. What does it tell us? This is work listed, and on the left-hand side, you have books, Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, etc. Stupid White Men. On the right, you have other books like What's So Great About America? Letters to a Young Conservative, Hell to Pay, and so on and so forth. So these are books which are more aligned with the President of the United States, whereas those here on the left-hand side are more Democrat-liberal books. And the interesting thing is that that graph was built on the co-purchasing behavior at Amazon.com, and what we learn is that people just want to self-affirm themselves. Democrat, you buy Democrat books. If you're a Republican, you buy Republican books. And there's only one book which connects those two. What went wrong? Now, think about not only collective intelligence, which we saw aggregating across thousands of buyers of books, but think about competitive intelligence. Think about finding out what people are saying about you. For example, here is what Technorati, a company in San Francisco, has searched for Weigand.com in blog posts. And I am one of the worst bloggers in the universe. I, you know, hardly ever blog. So not surprising, my rank is 80,597. But still, there are here 70 links to my URL where people talk about me. And you want to know about this. You want to know what people are saying. You can potentially find out what, you know, you need to worry about. If people say, you know, he's a funny actor, well, there's not much I can do about it. On the other hand, if he says, you know, maybe he should, you know, tie his tie better or something, that's something I can do about that. So this is a way of finding out what the world thinks about you, at least that part of the world which figures out it's worth linking to you. So you could see that as doing market research on your own brand. And how much does it cost? You just need to know where to look. Who of you has heard about the long tail? Okay, I think all of you know what a power law is. Power law. No, not a distribution. A power law means that if you take something, you have some measurement, you have a value, you measure, like you measure the height of people. Bad example. You measure the income in Russia. Each person has an income. And the income of all people, and then you sort, okay? You just sort the most richest person on top. Who's the richest person?
Abramovich.
Okay, Abramovich on top. And who's the poorest person? Don't know. We don't know the poorest. By the way, in the United States, it's interesting. Apparently, Bill Gates, either it is his wealth or his income, probably his wealth, is as big as the 40% cumulative distribution of all the poorest people. So a huge imbalance between wealth distribution and people. So it's not a normal distribution, not a log-normal distribution either, but it's a power law. A power law means you take the income people have, you stem the richest person here, second richest person here, third richest person there, etc., and then you plot on the y-axis their actual. And you now actually take the log of both axes, and it's a straight line. And you do this with anything which is generated by people. It could be the reviews Amazon reviewers read. The most prolific reviewer is here. The least prolific one is here. And it's a straight line. I'll show you the picture if you want. Or you could say, I'm looking at how many reviews a certain item receives. And it's what? It's again a straight line. That the most popular item, say Harry Potter, has probably half a reviews. I need to look up the number. Has certainly thousands of reviews. Whereas the least popular item has how many reviews?
Zero.
And somewhere there is a one in lots of books that bought it. So all these things are straight lines and logarithms or power laws. So that means that the tail of the distribution, if you don't plot it at log-log, but as lin-lin, of course, the way it looks is that it drops off like this. So physical stores, to compute the rent per square centimeter, say for a CD, it's half centimeters, the rent they pay, Moscow very expensive. And from that, they know the margin, they know how many CDs they have to pay to sell a year in order to pay the rent for the store. That means they need to focus on the head of the distribution. That's what drives the so-called hit economy. That people work very hard for the next hit, the next really well-selling something. That's the tyranny of the physical space. Chris Anderson, the author of this book, The Long Tail, based on an article he wrote in Wired magazine 2 years ago, calls it. Now, I told you about discovery based on attention other people pay. I told you about recommendation economy. People bought X, also bought Y. What this does is it allows us to get into that tail of the distribution, discover that tail of the distribution. In the olden days, when you had experts writing reviews, you wouldn't get to the tail of the distribution because the experts presumably don't know about 1 million in the tail of the distribution. But people bought X also bought Y, or people clicked at X also clicked Y. That is one way how we can enter in the tail of the distribution. And that, you remember the story about Delicious? About you getting on the heels of the other guy who finds all that interesting stuff for you without worrying about statistically averaging, that also helps you tail off the distribution. Because enough if one guy finds it and he has lots of people follow him. So what happens to this curve is that this actually is much flatter than what it used to be. And in the case of Amazon.com, people have estimated MIT, more than half of the books which are shipped by Amazon, more than half of the revenues of Amazon.com are actually in the tail of the distribution, in the stuff which you cannot buy in a physical bookstore. That is the first part, the tail of the distribution. The tail gets lifted up by people discovering stuff. Now to the second story. From physics, you know that typically different effects pull in opposite directions. Not so here. The second effect also emphasizes the tail of the distribution, and that is what I said about architecture of participation. People produce in the tail of the distribution. All of you who do podcasts or who take photos with their cameras and upload them, you are producers in the tail of the distribution. So both the consumption and the discovery make it flatter, as well as the production. So we live in a world where the tail of the distribution becomes more important. I gave you the example of Amazon.com with books. The same applies for music. The same applies for movies. I'm not sure how close you are in culture to China. But there are two guys, maybe two and a half guys, the so-called back dorm boys from Guangzhou in Canton province in the southern part of China. 24-year-old guys who went to the local university there. And they lip sync in, you know, red sports suits. They lip sync to Backstreet songs. In China, everybody knows them. In America, everybody knows them. So this parody, the Back Dorm Boys did of the Backstreet Boys, is pretty well known. They have, when I asked friends of mine at Sina whether I could actually get in touch with them for another thing I did, they said, Andreas, you have to talk to their agent. Mm-hmm. So by now they have an agent. And I was told that they have millions and millions of downloads of them. And they are so popular in the world that I went to an event in San Francisco where actually there was a parody of the Backdoor Boy by one guy who called it Backdoor Boy, which was, of course, another story. So those things travel globally, and I just decided to try out on a search what all comes up when you enter Backdoor Boys, and you get the feeling of just how much is happening in this of peer production. This graph is from Netflix, same idea. Most of the titles they rent out are not available in physical stores such as Blockbuster. Here is my example where somebody asked before about SIP, statistically improbable phrases. That is the interface somebody wants to know, and this one came and flagged for me a way of creating architectures of participation. This again is about the tail of the distribution. He would not get the answer in the head of his book, but he has to find somebody out there who knows the answer. Finally, last 5 minutes, octaves of interaction.
May I just, I'm not sure
five minutes.
Everybody understood that.
Okay.
Long tails.